King Solomon's Mines. By H. Rider Haggard. Told by Stan Winiarski. It's a curious thing that at my age, 45 last birthday, I should find myself taking up a pen to try to write this history. I wonder what sort of history it'll be when I'm done with it, if I ever come to the end of the trip. I've done a good many things in my life, which seems a long one to me, owing to my having begun so young, perhaps. At an age when other boys are at school, I was earning my living as a trader in the old colony. I've been trading, hunting, fighting, or mining ever since. And yet, it's only 8 months ago that I made my fortune. It's a big one now I've got it. I don't yet know how big, but I don't think I would go through the last 15 or 16 months again for it. No, not if I knew that I should come out safe at the end, money and all. But then, I don't like violence, and I'm pretty sick of adventure. It's 18 months or so ago since I first met Sir Henry Curtis and Captain Good, and it was in this way. I'd been up elephant hunting beyond Bamangwato, and had had bad luck. Everything went wrong that trip, and to top it off, I got the fever badly. So soon as I was well enough, I trekked down to the diamond fields, sold such ivory as I had, and also my wagon and oxen, discharged my hunters, and took the postcard to the Cape. After spending a week in Cape Town, finding that they overcharged me at the hotel, and having seen everything there was to see, including the botanical gardens, which seemed to me likely to confer a great benefit on the country, and the new Houses of Parliament, which I expect will do nothing of the sort, I determined to go on back to Natal by the Dunkeld, then lying in the docks waiting for the Edinburgh Castle due in from England. I took my berth, then went aboard, and that afternoon the Natal passengers from the Edinburgh Castle transshipped, and we put out to sea. Among the passengers who came on board, there were two who excited my curiosity. One, a man of about 30, was one of the biggest-chested and longest-armed men I ever saw. He had yellow hair, a big yellow beard, clear-cut features, and large gray eyes set deep into his head. I never saw a finer-looking man, and somehow he reminded me of an ancient Dane. I found out his name was Sir Henry Curtis. The other man who stood talking to Sir Henry was short, stout, and dark, and of quite a different cut. I suspected at once that he was a naval officer. I don't know why, but it's difficult to mistake a navy man. I've gone on shooting trips with several of them in the course of my life, and they've always been the best, bravest, and nicest fellows I ever met, though given to the use of profane language. Well, I was right. I found out that he was a naval officer, a lieutenant of 31, who after 17 years' service had been turned out of Her Majesty's employ with the barren honor of a commander's rank, because it was impossible that he should be promoted. Captain John Good was rather a curious man to look at. He was so very neat and so very clean-shaved, and he always wore an eyeglass in his right eye. It seemed to grow there, for it had no string, and he never took it out except to wipe it. Soon after we got under way, evening closed in, and brought with it very dirty weather. And as for that Dunkeld, she's a flat-bottomed punt, and going up light as she was, she rolled very heavily. It was quite impossible to walk about, so I stood near the engines where it was warm, and amused myself with watching the pendulum, which was fixed opposite to me, swinging slowly backwards and forwards as the vessel rolled, and marking the angle she touched at each lurch.
"That pendulum's wrong. It is not properly weighted,"
suddenly said a voice at my shoulder, somewhat testily. Looking round, I saw the naval officer I had noticed when the passengers came aboard.
"Indeed. Now what makes you think so?"
"Think so? I don't think at all. Why there?"
as she righted herself after a roll.
"If the ship had really rolled to the degree that thing pointed to, then she would never have rolled again. That's all. But it is just like these merchant skippers. They always are so confoundedly careless."
Just then the dinner bell rang, and I wasn't sorry, for it's a dreadful thing to have to listen to an officer of the Royal Navy when he gets onto that subject. I only know one worse thing, and that's to hear a merchant skipper express his candid opinion of officers of the Royal Navy. Captain Good and I went down to dinner together,
and there we found Sir Henry Curtis already seated. He and Captain Good sat together, and I sat opposite to them. The captain and I soon got into talking about shooting and whatnot, he asking me many questions, and I answering as well as I could. Presently, he got on to elephants.
"Ah, sir," called out somebody who was sitting near me, "you have got the right man for that. Hunter Quatermain should be able to tell you about elephants if anybody can."
Sir Henry, who had been sitting quite quiet listening to our talk, started visibly.
"Excuse me, sir,"
he said, leaning forward across the table and speaking in a low, deep voice, a very suitable voice, it seemed to me, to come out of those great lungs.
"Excuse me, sir, but is your name Alan Quatermain?"
I said it was.
"Mr. Quatermain, the year before last, about this time, you were, I believe, at a place called Bamangwato, to the north of the Transvaal."
"I was," I answered, rather surprised that this gentleman should be so well acquainted with my movements, which weren't, so far as I was aware, considered of general interest.
"I was. I took up a wagon load of goods and made a camp outside the settlement and stopped till I had sold them."
Sir Henry was sitting opposite to me in a Madeira chair, his arms leaning on the table. He now looked up, fixing his large gray eyes full upon my face. There was a curious anxiety in them, I thought.
"Did you happen to meet a man called Neville there?"
"Oh, yes. He outspanned alongside of me for a while to rest his oxen before going on to the interior. I had a letter from a lawyer a few months back asking me if I knew what had become of him, which I answered to the best of my ability at the time."
"Yes. Your letter was forwarded to me. You said in it that the gentleman called Neville left Bamangwato in the beginning of May in a wagon with a driver, a Kaffir hunter called Jim, announcing his intention of trekking, if possible, as far as Inyati, the extreme trading post in the Matabele country, where he would sell his wagon and proceed on foot. You also said that he did sell his wagon, for 6 months afterwards you saw the wagon in the possession of a Portuguese trader who told you that he had bought it at Inyati from a white man whose name he had forgotten, and that the white man, with a native servant, had started off for the interior on a shooting trip, he believed."
"Yes."
"Mr. Quatermain, I suppose you know or can guess nothing more of the reasons of my, of Mr. Neville's journey to the northward, or as to what point that journey was directed?"
"I heard something," I answered, and stopped. The subject was one which I didn't care to discuss. Sir Henry and Captain Good looked at each other, and Captain Good nodded.
"Mr. Quatermain, I am going to tell you a story, and ask your advice, and perhaps your assistance. The agent who forwarded me your letter told me that I might implicitly rely upon it, as you were, he said, well known and universally respected in Natal, and especially noted for your discretion."
I bowed and drank some whiskey and water to hide my confusion, for I'm a modest man, and Sir Henry went on.
"Mr. Neville was my brother."
"Oh," I said, starting, for now I knew who Sir Henry had reminded me of when I first saw him. His brother was a much smaller man, and had a dark beard, but now I thought of it, he possessed eyes of the same shade of gray and with the same keen look in them, and the features, too, weren't unlike.
"He was my only and younger brother. Until 5 years ago, I do not suppose we were ever a month away from each other. But just about 5 years ago, a misfortune befell us, as sometimes does happen in families. We quarreled bitterly, and I behaved very unjustly to my brother in my anger. As I dare say you know, if a man dies intestate, he has no property but land, real property it is called in England. It all descends to his eldest son. It so happened that just at the time when we quarreled, our father died intestate. He had put off making his will until it was too late. The result was that my brother, who had not been brought up to any profession, was left without a penny. Of course, it would have been my duty to provide for him, but at the time the quarrel between us was so bitter that I did not, to my shame I say it, and he sighed deeply, offer to do anything. It was not that I grudged him anything, but I waited for him to make advances, and he made none. I am sorry to trouble you with all this, Mr. Quatermain, but I must make things clear, eh, Good?"
"Quite so, quite so," said the captain. "Mr. Quatermain will, I am sure, keep this history to himself."
"Of course," said I, for I rather pride myself on my discretion.
"Well, my brother had a few hundred pounds to his account at the time, and without saying anything to me, He drew out this paltry sum, and having adopted the name of Neville, started off for South Africa in the wild hope of making a fortune. This I heard afterwards. Some 3 years passed, and I heard nothing of my brother, though I wrote him several times. Doubtless the letters never reached him. But as time went on, I grew more and more troubled about him. I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that blood is thicker than water.
That's true, said I, thinking of my boy Harry.
I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that I would have given half my fortune to know that my brother George, the only relation I have, was safe and well, and that I should see him again.
Well, Mr. Quatermain, as time went on, I became more and more anxious to find out if my brother was alive or dead, and if alive, to get him home again. I set inquiries on foot, and your letter was one of the results. So far as it went, it was satisfactory, for it showed that till lately George was alive, but it did not go far enough. So, to cut a long story short, I made up my mind to come out and look for him myself, and Captain Good was so kind as to come with me.
Yes, said the captain, nothing else to do, you see. Turned out by my lords of the Admiralty to starve on half pay. And now, perhaps, sir, you will tell us what you know or have heard of the gentleman called Neville.
I heard this, and I have never mentioned it to a soul till today. I heard that he was starting for Solomon's Mines.
Solomon's Mines? Ejaculated both my hearers at once. Where are they?
I don't know. I know where they're said to be. I once saw the peaks of the mountains that border them, but there was 130 miles of desert between me and them, and I'm not aware that any white man ever got across it, save one. But perhaps the best thing I can do is to tell you the legend of Solomon's Mines as I know it, you passing your word not to reveal anything I tell you without my permission. Do you agree to that? I have my reasons for asking it. Sir Henry nodded, and Captain Good replied,
Certainly, certainly.
I was up beyond the Manica country at a place called Satanda's Kraal, and a miserable place it was, for one could get nothing to eat there, and there was but little game about. I had an attack of fever, and was in a bad way generally, when one day a Portuguese arrived with a single companion, a half-breed. The man reminded me of the polite dons I've read about. He was tall and thin, with large dark eyes and curling gray mustache. We talked together a little, for he could speak broken English, and I understood a little Portuguese, and he told me that his name was José Sylvester, and that he had a place near Delagoa Bay, and when he went on next day with his half-breed companion, he said,
Goodbye, senor. If ever we meet again, I shall be the richest man in the world, and I will remember you.
I laughed a little. I was too weak to laugh much, and watched him strike out for the great desert to the west, wondering if he was mad or what he thought he was going to find there. A week passed, and I got the better of my fever. One evening, I was sitting on the ground in front of the little tent I had with me, chewing the last leg of a miserable fowl I had bought from a native for a bit of cloth worth 20 fowls, when suddenly I saw a figure, apparently that of a European, for it wore a coat, on the slope of the rising ground opposite to me, about 300 yards away. The figure crept along on its hands and knees, then it got up and staggered along a few yards on its legs, only to fall and crawl along again. Seeing that it must be somebody in distress, I sent one of my hunters to help him, and presently he arrived. And who do you suppose it turned out to be?
José Sylvester, of course,
said Captain Good. Yes, José Sylvester, or rather his skeleton and a little skin. His face was bright yellow with fever, and his large dark eyes stood nearly out of his head, for all his flesh had gone. There was nothing but yellow, parchment-like skin, white hair, and the gaunt bones sticking up beneath. I gave him water with a little milk in it, and he drank it in great gulps, 2 quarts or more, without stopping. Then he groped in his shirt and brought out what I thought was a tobacco pouch made of skin. He said feebly,
The paper has it all. It took me years to read. My ancestor, a political refugee from Lisbon, and one of the first Portuguese who landed on these shores, wrote it when he was dying on those mountains which no white foot ever pressed before or since. His name was José da Silvestra, and he lived 300 years ago. His slave, who waited for him on this side of the mountains, found him dead and brought the writing home to Delagoa. It has been in the family ever since, but none have cared to read it till at last I did, and I have lost my life over it. But another may succeed and become the richest man in the world. Only give it to no one. Go yourself.
Then he began to wander again, and in an hour it was all over. God rest him, he died very quietly.
Aye, but the document,
said Sir Henry in a tone of deep interest. The original is at my home in Durban, together with poor Dom Jose's translation, but I have the English rendering in my pocketbook and a facsimile of the map, if it can be called a map. Here it is.
I, Jose da Silvestra, who am now dying of hunger in the little cave where no snow is on the north side of the nipple of the southernmost of the two mountains I have named Sheba's Breasts, write this in the year 1590 with a cleft bone upon a remnant of cloth, my blood being the ink. With mine own eyes have I seen the countless diamonds stored in Solomon's treasure chamber, but through the treachery of Gagul the witch hunter, I might bring naught away. Let him who comes follow the map and climb the snow of Sheba's left breast till he comes to the nipple, on the north side of which is the great road Solomon made, from whence 3 days' journey to the king's palace. Let him kill Gagul. Pray for my soul. Farewell, Jose da Silvestra.
When I'd finished reading the above and shown the copy of the map, there followed a silence of astonishment.
Well, said Captain Good, I have been round the world twice and put in at most ports, but may I be hung if ever I heard a yarn like that out of a storybook, or in it either, for the matter of that.
It's a queer story, Mr. Quatermain, said Sir Henry. I suppose you are not hoaxing us. It is, I know, sometimes thought allowable to take a greenhorn in.
You'll see the original map in writing when we reach Durban. But I haven't told you about your brother. I knew the man Jim who was with him. He was a Bechuana by birth, a good hunter, and for a native a very clever man. The morning Mr. Neville was starting, I saw Jim standing by my wagon and cutting up tobacco on the disselboom.
Jim, where are you off to this trip?
Is it elephants?
No, boss. We are after something worth more than ivory.
And what might that be?
Diamonds, boss.
Then you're going in the wrong direction.
Boss, have you ever heard of Solomon's Berg?
I started visibly. Your master will feed the vultures if he tries to reach Solomon's country, and so will you.
He grinned.
Mayhap, boss. Man must die. I'd rather like to try a new country myself. The elephants are getting worked out about here.
Ah, my boy, you wait till death gets a grip of your yellow throat, and then we'll hear what sort of tune you sing. Half an hour after that, I saw Neville's wagon move off. Presently Jim came running back.
Goodbye, boss. I didn't like to start without bidding you goodbye, for I dare say you are right, and we shall never come back again.
Is your master really going to Solomon's Berg, Jim, or are you lying?
No, he is going. He told me he was bound to make his fortune somehow, or try to, so he might as well try the diamonds.
And that's all I know about your brother, Sir Henry, but I am much afraid.
Mr. Quatermain, I am going to look for my brother. I am going to trace him to Solomon's Mountains, and over them if necessary, till I find him, or till I know that he is dead. Will you come with me?
I am, as I think I've said, a cautious man, indeed a timid one, and I shrank from such an idea. It seemed to me that to start on such a journey would be to go to certain death, and putting other things aside, as I had a son to support, I couldn't afford to die just then.
No, thank you, Sir Henry. I think I'd rather not. I have a son dependent on me, so I can't afford to risk my life.
Both Sir Henry and Captain Good looked very disappointed.
Mr. Quatermain, I am well off, and I am bent upon this business. You may put the remuneration for your services at whatever figure you like, in reason, and it shall be paid over to you before we start. Moreover, I will, before we start, arrange that in the event of anything happening to us, or to you, that your son shall be suitably provided for. You will see from this how necessary I think your presence. Also, if by any chance we should reach this place and find diamonds, they shall belong to you and Good equally. I do not want them. But of course, the chance is as good as nothing, though the same thing would apply to any ivory we might get. You may pretty well make your own terms with me, Mr. Quatermain, and of course I shall pay all expenses.
Sir Henry, this is the most liberal offer I ever had. but I must take time to think it over. I'll give you my answer before we get to Durban.
Very good.
And then I said goodnight and turned in and dreamt about poor long-dead Sylvester and the diamonds. It takes from 4 to 5 days, according to the vessel and the state of the weather, to run up from the Cape to Durban. At last, one beautiful evening in January, which is our hottest month, we steamed along the coast of Natal, expecting to make Durban Point by sunset. We all, that is, Sir Henry Curtis, Captain Good, and myself, went and sat by the wheel and were quiet for a while.
Well, Mr. Quatermain, have you been thinking about my proposals?
I rose and knocked out my pipe before I answered. I had not made up my mind, and wanted the additional moment to complete it. Before the burning tobacco had fallen into the sea, it was completed. Just that little extra second did the trick. Yes, gentlemen, I will go.